Application Academy is closing if you are applying to medical school in 2024 to start in 2025. We are closing in mid-April, April 12th or 13th, somewhere around there, somewhere in mid-April. We're closing our door. It's time for you to get in to Application Academy to get the support you need to put together your story so that you aren't one of those students that end up rejected because you didn't know how to tell your story. Come join us at applicationacademy.com. Use the promo code podcast for a little extra discount. Use the promo code podcast for a little extra discount. I'll see you soon at applicationacademy.com. The pre-med path can be super confusing. If you'd love some help on your path or on your applications, use the promo code PMY for pre-med years, PMY, over at medicalschoolhq.net and get some help from some of our experts, former directors of admissions, admissions officers, other experts. We have a small team ready to help you today. Again, that's promo code PMY to get a discount on our services at medicalschoolhq.net. If you're applying to medical school in 2022 to start medical school in 2023, join me Wednesday or Thursday, Wednesday night at 9:30 p.m. Eastern or Thursday at 11 a.m. Eastern at premedworkshop.com. Go register today. I'm going to show you how to tell your story in your application. Again, that's premedworkshop.com. If you are applying to medical school in 2022, be there or be square. The pre-med year, session number 401. Hello, and welcome to The Pre-Med Years, where we believe that collaboration, not competition, is key to your success. I'm your host, Dr. Ryan Gray, and in this podcast, we share with you stories, encouragement, and information that you need to know to help guide you on your path to becoming a physician. Welcome to the pre-med years. Thank you so much for taking some time to join me today. I have an amazing guest today, and I think it wasn't planned this way, but I think it was meant to be after my kind of sobering episode 400 last week, which if you didn't listen to, I would recommend you go listen to. It was kind of a state of the pre-med union address where I basically said I was very disappointed with the WMC and with a lot of what's going on and wanted to figure out how I can help and be part of the solution to this. And Dr. Tade Ayeni reached out to me earlier this month and said, hey, here's who I am. Here's what I do. Here's what I want to talk to you about. And it was just very fortuitous. Dr. Ayeni is the Director of Diversity and Equity at Hackensack School of Medicine. And we had an amazing conversation about diversity and equity and so much more, just about why the medical schools are doing this, why it's important to them, and how you can help. So that is the conversation that you are about to have. I had a blast talking to Dr. Ayeni, and we're definitely going to keep talking. And I mentioned a project that I'm working on with him, and I'm excited to continue our relationship. So I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did. This is Dr. Tade Ayeni, Director of Diversity and Equity at Hackensack School of Medicine. Now, Tade, welcome to the pre-med years. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you. It's definitely a pleasure to be here today. Thank you for having me.
I'm excited to chat. I'm excited that you reached out to me. Why don't we start with a little bit about who you are, where you're at in this whole pre-med medical school world?
Okay, sure. So what I'm currently doing now is I'm the Director of Diversity and Equity at Hackensack School of Medicine, which is in North New Jersey. My background prior to that is teaching at the collegiate and at the graduate level, diversity, equity, social justice, and all those related things. And my real specialty is how does that look when you actually put it into practice? Those are easy concepts to get, but once you try to actually apply them, super messy. So that's kind of what I do.
Diversity and equity, diversity and inclusion is another common title that some people hear at different medical schools will have. I think a lot of pre-med students will hear that term and they go, oh, wait, I know who you are, or I know that office. They've reached out to me before after I took the MCAT, right? Yeah. The MCAT, a lot of students aren't aware that there's a checkbox when you register for the MCAT and take it that flags something in the system to say, hey, I'm underrepresented minority. And schools will go, hey, like, we're interested in you. Talk about that process, and just briefly, because that's probably the most common interaction that a lot of students are going to have with the D&E and D&I offices at medical schools.
So let me talk about the actual background to that. So people might ask, doesn't that create like an unfair advantage? Why do they get all this attention? Well, a number that should be startling to us is this. So you have the modern civil rights movement in the 1960s. From the time of the 1970s, the number of Black male doctors has not increased.
Yep.
So we have the same rate of Black male doctors as in 2020, as we had literally right after the modern civil rights movement. I'm talking black and white TV, right?
Yeah.
And so what that does in terms of practice is that there's just a huge deficit. Nothing wrong with a white male doctor. That is wonderful whenever anyone with a heart for serving people becomes a doctor. And what we're seeing is that the more diversity you have within a field, it's not just, you know, so that we can kind of tick a box. It's because it really strengthens that field. That creates diversity of thought. Hopefully sometime within this time, I'll tell you a really interesting story about a fourth year Harvard med student that'll really kind of bring that point out. But basically that's why you see the kind of emphasis on that.
Yeah.
And then
I'll just stop you full stop right there. Just to hammer home that thought for the student listening or watching this on YouTube. If you have any doubt or question potentially about affirmative action, about why medical schools want to reach out to minorities who may have less stats than you, and you think that's not fair, know that the data proves in quotes, because data is data, and kind of manipulate anyway, but the data shows that when there's more diversity of thought, as you mentioned, when we have voices and upbringings just representing different parts of our country, different parts of our world, we have better outcomes. So we obviously want better outcomes. So just get on board with, okay, better outcomes is what I want. Okay, I will accept, right? If anything else, just take that.
Yeah. And you know what I would get, so just to kind of add on to that, is a common thing that I hear is, I am a white male. I am a straight white male from a middle class to wealthy town. Does that mean that med schools are not looking for me? What I would say is this: if you want to differentiate yourself in terms of diversity, you just start working towards that now. Because what we're simultaneously looking for is, on the one hand, we don't have enough black male doctors. We don't have enough black female doctors. We don't have enough. We don't have enough doctors from all these types of backgrounds. But on the other hand, what we're looking for is, you could be a white male doctor who has never interacted with anything related to diversity, or you could be a white male doctor who, for lack of a better term, gets it. And you'll still have a huge impact within any community that you actually work towards. So if you're not from one of these kind of underrepresented backgrounds and you have that concern, one thing you can do is start working towards diversity today. that'll be a huge feather in your cap later on.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think it was a YouTube video that I did not too long ago where I talked about diversity and the kind of diversity essay that's very common on a lot of secondaries for medical schools. And I the way that I framed it for students was don't, especially for that, right, that cisgendered white male, yeah, is don't think about it from, oh, I can't bring diversity to the class because, yeah, I'm a white guy. The color of my skin doesn't allow that. The core of the question is really going back to that thought diversity is, what are your experiences? What are your skills? What are your traits? What are you bringing from that arena to the class? And how are you going to add to the class? Not, I'm a black guy, so therefore I'm diverse.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. What I would really say to that is that sometimes what is, so let me tell you about something. It's just a quick 30-second story, something that happened to me. I was in a work situation, and one of my white female coworkers reached over and touched my hair. And okay, if you know black people, ask that,
no. Get your greasy hands off my head.
that is just, you know, you just try not to touch other humans, right? Unless they ask you, right? So it happened once, and it was so shocking that I just didn't do anything. I just kind of looked uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And then did
she appreciate that? She was like, oh, mate, I shouldn't have done that.
No. And you know, what I would say is that she had no type of bad intention. We had a really good relationship. Yep. Yeah. And so, you know, it wasn't like she was trying to make me uncomfortable.
Yep.
And then it happened again where she was kind of reaching towards my hair and I was leaning away. And one of my white male colleagues kind of looked at her like, oh, no, we can't do that. And that was really powerful. That, like, you know, of course a black person can actually tell you, hey, that's not okay. And here's why that is okay. But, you know, one thing that just in the field of diversity that we're looking to do more and more is we're trying to make this a responsibility of everyone. If you're a human, then diversity matters to you. It's not if you're part of a minority group. So to see him kind of react the way that you would expect me to react was really powerful. She got it. And also I felt like, wow, thank you for that. You know? And so that's things like that. That's how, you know, you could be part of a group that is traditionally not considered minority in any way, but you still have very much a kind of important role to play.
Yeah. Talk about it from a medical school perspective, right? Again, the student listening or watching this is going to be the student who is applying for one of those coveted spots. And their guess and some people's stance is, look, the students with the best GPAs, the best MCAT scores, the most shadowing experiences and clinical experiences, those are the ones that should be getting those spots in medical schools, right? And just if we want to ignore what I said a minute ago about diversity of thought is better for everyone, we want to ignore that for a second. Talk about what that process is like from a medical school perspective, why you are so focused on bringing in that diversity, why you have to be so focused on it, number one, why aren't African-American students scoring just as well on the MCAT, right? If you look at the AAMC data, it's almost 10 points lower on average for African-American students, which is horrendous.
Yeah.
Why is there so much focus on it just from, not from a we want diversity standpoint, but why does there need to be that focus on it? And then number two, really, what is the process that a school goes through to find those students?
Yeah, so let me give you a kind of current thing that just happened 3 months ago. So I think it was in April. People started looking at all the COVID-19 deaths in
Chicago.
Yeah. And what they found was this. Black residents of Chicago made up 68%, so almost 70% of all the COVID-19 deaths.
Yep.
But Black people only make up 30% of Chicago's population. So they make up less than half of the population, but they're dying, but they're still making up the majority of those deaths. And, you know, people started asking, how could this be? Well, there's one simple stat that will really help with that. You look way before COVID and you say, what's the difference in terms of life expectancy for a Black resident of Chicago versus a white resident? It was actually 9 to 10 years. Mm. So way before COVID, what we were saying is, if you're Black and you live in Chicago, everything's equal, you will die probably 9 to 10 years earlier than that person who lives in the same city, in the same country, 45 minutes down the street. Why? Because of all these different social determinants of health. And so what we're finding within the medical field is that people are having drastically different results related to health. So that's the kind of background. Now, we say, how do we fix that? What can we do about that? We either just kind of accept it and say, we just live in a world where if you're part of a certain group, you're just going to have worse health, and too bad. Or we say, hey,
you did it to yourself, right? You should have exercised, try harder, don't eat exactly that McDonald's. Talk about, but before we dive into that, you mentioned social determinants of health. And I think probably a lot of students, maybe that's the first time they're hearing that term. But talk about it from an angle, if you could. There's a lot of discussion about systemic racism in this country and how it doesn't exist, and slavery ended 400 years ago, some people like to say, which is not true. But that slavery ended however long ago it ended, and discrimination based on race was made illegal in the 60s, 1960s, I think it was.
Yeah. And we've had a Black president. So
we've had a Black president who was elected twice. Therefore, how can we be? I love that one. I have a Black friend. How can we help? Right. And how can we help students to really open up their eyes to what everyone in the U.S. and potentially world is calling systemic racism? How do we open up their eyes to show them that it exists for those who don't want to see it?
Well, what I would say about this is, as you're listening to this, you may be one of two camps. You either are clear that it is a big problem, or you're like, I don't know. And the reason people say, I don't know, is because systemic racism is really hard to see. The way that I kind of describe it is isolated happenings where something racist happens. That's really easy to see. That's like when you go to the doctor and you have a cough. Now, if the reason for your cough is pneumonia, you can't just look at a human being and say, that person has pneumonia, but you can see that they're coughing. And then you run a few different tests. A really good example of how systemic racism of how that looks is, I point to a study done in 2001 to 2002, where researchers created 5,000 resumes all the same, and all they changed was the name. And they sent it to 1,300 different companies, and they purposely picked quote unquote Black sounding names and white sounding names.
Yep.
So on one resume, I think it was Greg. Another resume, it was Jamal. One resume was Emily. Another resume, it was LaKeisha. Mm-hmm. And they sent out the same exact resumes to companies. And you know what the difference was?
It was huge.
50%.
I know this study,
50% callback rate. Yeah. So then they said to themselves, 50% callback rate for the white sounding resumes. Mm-hmm. Right? And then they said to themselves, what if we improve all the resumes? So they improved them all and sent them back out with the logic that you send out a better resume, you get a better result. The resumes with the white sounding names had a 30% increase for the improved resumes. The resumes with the Black sounding names had a 0% increase. Now here's my actual point. That's an example of systemic racism, but how could you see that without doing a full-on study sending 5,000 resumes out?
Yeah.
And so, for those who don't believe that it's a problem, I can see why you don't believe, because it's very hard to see. Basically, a simple way to think about it is that there are seemingly harmless things in our system that produces drastically different results. And so you just take that study that I talked about and just apply it to the medical world, and you start to see a lot of the same outcomes. Really quickly, let me just give you a basic example. A study was done where they reviewed 10,000 hospital records. And what they were trying to find out was, do patients receive the same amount of pain medication after the same surgical procedures?
Yeah.
And what they found was that Black patients, after getting the same exact surgical procedure done, were 40% less likely to receive enough pain medication. And, you know, so then we know that has a huge
Todd,
impact.
Obviously that's because Black people don't experience pain as much, right? We know that. It's in textbooks, Todd. I've seen the textbooks.
Yeah, and this is why I'm here, so that we can start to, you know, deal with.
And it wasn't that long ago that the medical students were surveyed, and there's still a large prevalence of active medical students who yep. believe this myth. And mm-hmm. and I don't know where that comes from. Obviously it's racism. I understand, right? Your parents teach you that Black people are bad and oh this mm-hmm. and oh that, but they're not sitting around going, did you know Black people experience less pain than white people? Like, where does that come from?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, when I teach about systemic racism, and I present all these shocking numbers, people's next question is this: okay, we're on board. I now agree with you. It's a huge problem. How can you send out one resume that's the same and have a completely different response? And then the next question is this: how does it work? What can we do about it? And I always point to these two words, implicit bias.
Oh, yeah.
And now the important thing to remember about implicit bias is that our implicit bias can be, and in many cases is, directly opposite of our explicit beliefs. Mm-hmm. So, for example, I as a man can say, I truly believe that women are equal to men. And I'm not just saying that, I really believe that. Mm-hmm. Now, if I were to take an implicit bias test, it wouldn't be shocking to find that my implicit bias is high in negativity towards women.
Todd, if there was a tire that had to be changed and a woman said, give me the wrench, I'm sure you'd be like, are you strong enough to do that? Right? That implicit bias would kick in and be like, mm-hmm. no, I got it. Don't worry.
Yeah. And you know, like when I talk about it, what I always point to is there's this one simple key, which is implicit bias itself. It's not actually bad. It's just a description of how our brain processes info. So I always use this kind of example. Whenever I go to Starbucks, I get the same thing. Grande toffee nut latte with one sugar, with one brown sugar. So when I was living in Philly going to grad school, after 10 days of going to the same place, eventually, I could be the 15th person in line. The barista would just look at me. You want the usual? I'm like, yeah, sure. So, so they eventually just created a mental link. You see me, you see a grande toffee nut latte, and so that was a way of saving ourselves time. So mm-hmm. then you ask, hey, that's a really cool story. What does this have to do with anything that we're just talking about? Well, it's very simple. The problem is not implicit bias.
Yep.
It's how our brain creates mental links.
Yep.
Just by virtue of being born into the society that we've been born into, we're constantly exposed to images of minorities doing negative things and images of people in the majority group doing positive things.
Yep.
A really good example, Google got in a lot of trouble in 2016, because if you just typed into Google three Black teenagers, mm-hmm. mugshots came up. And if you typed in three white teenagers, then pictures of people doing normal stuff come up, right?
Playing polo.
So your brain's always seeing that.
Yeah.
You know, and so what happens is, even though explicitly you say, I have no problem with Black people whatsoever, I believe that they're equal to me, right?
Yeah.
But you've been constantly seeing that, so that your implicit bias causes you to unintentionally help to maintain a structure of oppression.
And that's right. And part of it, as you mentioned, right, these shortcuts, that's just the way that we're wired to conserve energy, to process things faster. We quote unquote stereotype and categorize everything. There's so many good podcasts about this kind of stuff. But it's what happens next and where was that programming from to begin with? And it's interesting to see a lot of change happening now. And some people will think it's silly and useless and a waste of time. Things like whitelist and blacklist for like the phone numbers that we'll allow to come in is the whitelist. Those are the good phone numbers, and the blacklist, that's the bad phone numbers. And white and black, I was trying to learn some history on it, goes back way further than slavery. But it's still this kind of unconscious, like white is good, black is bad. And when we're in a society, especially in this country, where that's an issue, right? Let's try to fix it. Why not?
Yeah. So. And you know, what's interesting about what you said, that speaks to race as a social construct. And the way that I break that down for people is, so I was born in Nigeria, but raised in the United States. You know, the interesting thing about being in Nigeria is that in a sense, there's no such thing as black.
Yep.
So think of it like this. You're in a society where all the police and judges and lawyers and doctors are all black.
Yeah.
And all the criminals are all black. So
on black crime. Oh man.
So, you know, people stop. So okay. A common thing that I've noticed is this. A lot of people born and raised on the African continent, they discover that they're black when they get to the United States because they've never thought of associating anything good or bad with being black, because everyone's black.
Yep.
So to say I'm black in Nigeria is like standing up in a medical school classroom and saying I'm a med student. Well,
obviously. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm a human. Yeah. I have one story that is kind of along those lines. I went to Kenya back in 1998, and we were staying upcountry from Nairobi and staying at a local's house. And my grandmother had to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night, right? And it's an outhouse, so you have to leave the house and go out. And so when she was getting up, she woke up, got out of bed, and the like kids in the house were like, oh, like she's out of bed, let's go see if the white came off, right? They didn't understand, right, that our white skin was our white skin, and it wasn't like a paint or a costume or something else. They were really interested. They went to the bed to see if the white came off.
They just assumed everyone's black.
Yeah, it was very interesting, right? And that's cultural appreciation and just understanding is so important, really, to understand what's going on in this world and to really have a broader view of just, I was damn lucky to be born in this country as a white guy, but that doesn't mean that I can't appreciate and understand what everyone else is going through and work to make it better for everyone else. And really, at the end of the day, your role at the medical school is, how do I bring that to a medical school class? So talk for a second. I want to kind of go to the roots of where a lot of this comes from a medical school perspective, right? I mentioned the AAMC data shows that African-American students score almost 10%, 10 points lower on the MCAT on average. Why is that? Besides, right, I guess we could just chalk it up to school systems and redlining and home values being tied to school. Like, do you think that's all it is? Or is the MCAT implicitly biased as well?
Well, what I would say is, a book that I think that everyone should read, that I think really takes that question and turns it into a whole book, is, I don't know if you've ever heard of Whistling Vivaldi. It's by Claude Steele.
No, and, but I'll add it to my list.
Yeah, sure. And so he brings up something called stereotype threat, which he said, basically, you know, when we talk about stereotypes, we always talk about it as how we view others, right? So we say things like men stereotype women, right? But The people who are being stereotyped, I mean, they're not unaware of their stereotype. Like if you asked a woman in the sciences, do you know what the stereotypes about women are? Or if you asked a black person, do you know what the stereotypes about black people are? Yeah. Or even a white person, do you know what the stereotypes about white people are? They actually know. Yeah. And so he brings up a really kind of interesting theory, which is that because we know what the stereotypes about us are, when we're put into situations where there might be a danger of us fulfilling that stereotype, that becomes a huge distraction to us while we're trying to actually accomplish the thing that we set out to do. So it's kind of like trying to write your 5-paragraph essay while also doing your math homework. Whereas someone who doesn't have stereotype threat can just focus on writing the essay.
So I heard of a story or a study testing this theory. I think this is the same theory that it's testing, mm-hmm. where they studied handing a test to students, right? Whether it was white students and black students whatever it was. And they said, here's a test. Everyone does great on this test and take it, right? And everyone does do great. Versus the other group was that, like, the tested group was, here's a test. Oh yeah. Oh, I'm sorry, you're black. Like, black students do much worse on this test. And it showed, right? Same exact test. Yeah. The group where students mm-hmm. weren't told that one group does worse, they all did the same. And the other group where students were told they did worse, they actually did worse. Is that the same?
Well, what they did is they went one step further. They didn't mention race. They just mentioned the actual stereotype with the assumption that that group knows what the stereotype about them is. Mm. So for kind of example, women in sciences, what are the stereotypes? They're not logical thinkers. They're not good at math. So they didn't even have to talk about them being a woman. They would say things like, this test measures your ability in math.
Oh.
And then to another group of women who had the same exact previous test scores, they would say, this test actually mentions something unrelated to math.
Yeah.
And they would find drastically different results. So what I would say is that the real answer to your question is, you know, people like nice, neat answers. I'd say that stereotype threat, you have to put it together with a bunch of other things that you've already mentioned, and that's the answer. But there's not this one golden thing that we can do that'll all of a sudden improve a lot of those test scores.
So for someone like myself who talks about the MCAT a lot for students, and we know based on the data, at least the numbers, that minorities do worse on this test, that ESL students do much worse on this test. Is that something we should be repeating, or should we just stop talking about it and go, good luck?
Well, I think that what you're really talking about is this. What we're realizing is that, the way that we think about medicine is for objective researchers, right? Like, if you want to be a doctor, you need to be objective and you need to be a researcher. Someone presents symptoms and you diagnose. And so that's how we like to think about medicine. Mm-hmm. But we have to remember that a lot of our medical practices today were not created in this objective bubble. They were really cemented, created, and formalized in the 20th century. Okay, what was happening in the 20th century? Well, for a lot of people listening, one thing that I always mention is this. If you are anywhere from 15 to 20 years older, if you're at least 15 years older, what that means is this. Your parents were probably born into a world where there were still black-only signs and white-only signs. Mm. That's how recent it was. And so that's where a lot of things related to medicine today were actually formalized.
Yeah.
So what that means is there are a lot of seemingly harmless things that are in there that unintentionally disadvantages people from certain groups without actually realizing it. At some point today, I want to tell you about an article from Lashira Nolan, who is a fourth-year med student.
Tell me right now.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, this is one of those articles. I think she wrote this when she was a first-year med student, and I read this, and I was like, what am I doing? I have all these degrees, and I've never done something this well. You know, I just wanted to just give up and just you know, pick up something else. And so she talked about, stage one Lyme disease, how do you diagnose it? They were going over this in her, I think in her microbiology class. And commonly, you should see a bullseye, a rash that looks like a bullseye on someone's skin.
Yep.
So the professor is covering this and they pull up a picture.
Yeah.
And
it's a white skin.
And it's a exactly.
Yeah.
It's a picture on white skin.
Yeah.
And she said, someone raised their hand and they said, would this be harder to see on darker skin? And basically the professor said, yes, it would. Good observation. And then moved on.
Move on.
Yeah. And so her point was that, you know, her kind of concern was that if it's harder to see on darker skin, yet we don't actually spend more time practicing how to see it, is this going to lead to drastically different health outcomes? And what she found was that, so stage one Lyme disease, you just have that bullseye looking rash. Stage three Lyme disease, you're presenting with things like arthritis, possible neurological things that are related to that. And what
you're not a medical doctor. I don't blame you for not knowing the symptoms
I'm trying to think of all the time. So you get what I'm saying.
I gotcha.
And so what she found was that basically in the field, there was a much higher percentage of white people being diagnosed with Lyme disease at stage one, which means there are more treatment options, and a much higher percentage of black people being diagnosed at stage three.
So let me stop you real quick, because what's going to pop into the head of someone who doesn't want to think down those lines, and maybe they're not listening anymore because they don't want to think down these lines, is they'll go, well, the white people were just taught the signs of tick bites and Lyme infection because their parents knew, and so it's their fault, not the doctor's fault, for not seeing it. How do you draw that line?
Oh, I'm really glad that you actually brought that up. So what that points us to this is this. In 1964, that is when hospitals became desegregated, legally speaking.
Yeah.
So I'll just repeat a story that I told before. Medgar Evers, civil rights leader, he was shot and he was bleeding out. And he's taken to a white-only hospital, and they said, hey, sorry, even though he's bleeding out, we can't see him here because this is a white-only hospital. They only let him in because he's Medgar Evers. So my point is that 50 years ago, 60, 70 years ago, if you were a white doctor, you were guaranteed to only see white patients. So it made sense that all these pictures should be of diseases on white skin, diseases in white people.
I didn't even think about it in that sense.
Yep. Wow. And so that was the social environment in which a lot of our medical practices today were actually formalized and cemented. So we have things that are leftovers from that. So it's not that someone is sitting around and saying, I want black people to have worse health outcomes, so let's make sure that we only use pictures of white skin. It's just that that's how it's been because of that particular background. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes complete sense.
And so that's why in kind of addition to, you know, obviously doing really well in chemistry, doing really well in biology, we're also looking to increase the diversity within medical school, you know, by actual just having more Hispanic, more black doctors, but also looking to have white doctors who are asking the kinds of questions that you're asking, because there's a large part of the population that's just not being serviced properly because the healthcare system that is serving them was produced in an environment where it was legal to not serve them.
Yeah, makes sense. All right, continue on with this woman's story. Is there more to it? This article?
Yeah, Yeah. Basically, her whole point was that you take this small detail, which is you just use that picture to recognize Lyme disease. Yeah. And it has a huge impact in the field. You have people who could have been diagnosed stage one now being diagnosed stage three. And then she added two more examples. She pointed out that when they learned CPR, they used white male mannequins. Mm. Well, how do you give CPR to someone who has breasts? Mm. How do you give CPR to a pregnant woman? So, all these different things she started to notice. And her whole point is that you have these huge healthcare problems in the field, and they all came from seemingly harmless details in medical school.
Yeah.
So that's why
I like that you frame it that way, right? Seemingly harmless. I think a huge wall that students are putting up and people are putting up with this whole systemic racism issue is, I'm not racist, right? I don't go out every day and go, I hate black people. Black people are bad. Therefore, systemic racism doesn't exist. It can't exist. But really, at the end of the day, as you said, right, these seemingly harmless little things, just they add up over time to, we have a healthcare system that's failing African Americans. We have an educational system that's failing African Americans. We have all these systems that are failing African Americans. Some things were done on purpose, but a lot of things are just small little things that just have added up.
Yeah. And, you know, what you said is the premise for another book that I would recommend. It's called How to Be an Anti-Racist.
Oh, and he's a Florida Gator. Yeah. So I haven't read that book yet, but I've listened to a bunch of his interviews and I love him. I forget his name off the top of my head, but yeah, I know he's a Gator.
Mm-hmm. and so his whole point is that there's a difference between not being racist and between being anti-racist. A really good example is something that is happening now, which is this. You could not have coronavirus, right? Now, how can you be anti-coronavirus? Put a mask on. Wear a mask when you go outside. So what is the difference? One is passive and one is active.
Yep.
And because even though, you know, you may not be racist, we were born into a society that had its structure created when racism was completely legal. So what that means is that it's not enough to just not do something. We need to be anti that thing.
Yeah, I love it. Ibram Kendi is the author.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Thank you. There was no way that I was going to remember that. So thank you.
Oh, awesome. What else as a parting gift here to the listener? What else? Really, I think at the end of the day, the question that I ask, unfortunately, it falls on a lot of my African American guests, which I'm learning through this on how to be an anti-racist. So it's not your job to teach me how to fix this problem. It's a white problem. And there is an amazing podcast series. I don't know if you've listened to it yet. Amazing podcast series called Seeing White, and it's from Seen on Radio is the podcast name. Seen on Radio, S-C-E-N-E, Seen on Radio. It's season two back from 2017, so it's before George Floyd and a lot of what's going on. And it's a 14-part season, and it's just phenomenal. And it takes a look at racism from the white side of it. Right. And how everything's been set up. And like, I was in tears listening to this, literally in tears, driving home from Chipotle, going to get lunch, listening to a story of the Dakota Native Americans going back to Minnesota, where they were kicked out of brutally. And just what the story in there was just, it was phenomenal. Wow. So amazing podcast series, everyone should listen to. But what I want to leave a student with, and hopefully thousands upon thousands upon thousands of students will hear this, will act on this, will work towards being an anti-racist, both as a pre-med student, as a medical student, as a physician, where can they start to be an anti-racist, to be an ally for the community, to promote diversity and equity among their peers, among their schools, wherever they are at now?
So I think that when that question is asked, everyone expects me to say, increase your knowledge. What I would say is that that is not bad, but there's a term that I recently coined just because I couldn't find another way to describe it. But one thing that I would say is you can track your non-transactional intergroup contact. Let me just break down what that actual term means. What it means is that although we are born into a society that's not legally segregated, most of us still live in a very segregated way. Meaning, if you're white, you come from a community that's predominantly white.
The good neighborhood, the clean neighborhood, right?
Yeah, you know, or if you're bilingual, everyone in your community is probably bilingual. If you're black, you come from a community that's predominantly black. Yeah. So then, when we interact with other groups, most of our interaction is transactional, meaning I'm white, I have a black coworker, or I'm black, I have a coworker who is Chinese American, right? But one thing that I always ask people is this: think about growing up and think about your own household now. If you have your own household now, how many people who don't look like you actually came into your house and had dinner when you were growing up? Now, here's why that's really important, because we talked about implicit bias before. One really interesting thing about implicit bias is that increasing our knowledge has a huge impact on our explicit bias, you know, like racism, right? Yeah. But it doesn't actually have that much of an impact on our implicit bias. What does is human experience. So one thing that you can do just to kind of tie that whole thought together is, whenever you talk about medicine and you want to see progress, what do? We always track it. So, for example, if I want to lose weight, I don't just start eating healthy and say, I feel lighter. I weigh myself and then I change my diet and then I weigh myself after, you know, 4 weeks, right? So same thing. What you can do is you can set a goal for non-transactional intergroup contact at the beginning of a month. And then look at how you did related to that goal at the end of that month. Here's why that's really important. Because what you and I just did today, that will do more for a human being related to everything that we talked about than listening to 14 lectures about implicit bias, about systemic oppression, different things like that. I have a close friend who, he says things that I'm like, you're insane. I mean, he just has a completely, you know, he's a white guy from a wealthy neighborhood, and you know, I'm not, right? Yep. And so he just has a completely different view about everything, but we're really close because we're able to have dialogue and still say, hey, I love you, man. And I've learned more from him, and he's learned more from, I've seen him have moments right in front of me where he was like, huh, I never thought about that. And see, so the more that you can increase your non-transactional intergroup contact, and what I would say is, how do you know whether it's increasing? You have to track it.
Yeah.
And so just in a simple way, non-transactional means that there's not an outward factor that's forcing you to have that particular transaction. It's not because you're at a restaurant and your waiter is Hispanic, you know, or black or white. It's not because you're at work. That will produce an environment where you can have real dialogue.
Yeah.
When you begin to have real dialogue, even if you never fully agree with a different human being, your view of that particular group will become layered as opposed to one dimensional. And that's something that you can start doing today.
I'm a huge fan of alliteration and buying website domains. And so as you were talking about this, these non-transactional interactions, I'm like, ooh, diversity dinners. That would be cool. I'm like, oh man, somebody already thought about that. Good idea. But that's really something, right? Have a group of students, have a sign-up sheet, have a potluck, bring different foods from different cultures. And I think that would be amazing. So yeah, I love it. All right, Hackensack. That's what, apparently everyone needs to apply to that school, because not only talking to you and all the amazing stuff it sounds like you guys are working on there, but I heard about Hackensack in a book recently talking about all the amazing things you're doing for the community. So that's where students should apply to school. So Todd, I thank you for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, there you go again, Dr. Tade Ayeni. Amazing, amazing conversation about diversity, about equity, equality, inclusion, and so much more. So if you are moved by this and you want to learn how to help, help diversity, help equity, maybe reach out to Dr. Ayeni and see. I hope you have a great week. We'll see you next time here on The Pre-Med Years.
This is MedEd Media.